You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And I was reading the comics the other time, and they have one. I don't know if you know the Wizard of Id. Mm-hmm. There's a tower, and somebody's up in the tower making announcements. You know, it's 10 o'clock and the rain is falling. But so this time it's 10 o'clock and time for the weather. And then in the next panel, that poor fellow has been totally dumped on by covered up entirely by snow. And then in the next panel, the sun's out, it's all melting and going whoosh. And then in the next panel, it's lightning and rain. And mm-hmm. He finishes sentences with March. It's March.
I have a very good friend. Hi, Stacy, who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's exactly what they're going through right now. It's spring, it's summer, it's winter, all in the same day, seemingly. Well, here in the Sacramento Valley, it is Wednesday, March 20th, as Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on Thursday, March 21st. And we do it in the morning. And the temperature right now is 48 degrees. The low this morning at my farm was 43 degrees, 43, 44. Pretty typical around the area right now. It is sunny. It has been utterly gorgeous in the Sacramento Valley for the last few days. We've had days in the 70s, people in shirt sleeves, nights dropping down, actually just a little below 50. We're having one of those March early warm spells, and this is rather amusing. Thing popped up on my Facebook feed from last year, which was exactly the same. We had warm temperatures mid-March, third week of March, followed by colder temperatures, and just so you all know, that's what's about to happen. So Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be mostly sunny and 70 degrees. Thursday night will be partly cloudy, change in the weather coming up, 49 degrees. Friday, there's about a 50% chance of showers in our area, and it will only be, 64 degrees. Friday night, showers are likely, then a chance of showers later Friday night, so it's only going to drop down to 48 degrees because of the cloud cover. Saturday is only going to get to 60 degrees. So we've been 74 degrees. It's going to be 60. It'll be the high on Saturday with a likelihood of showers. 70% chance of showers on Saturday. Saturday night, continued chance of showers. Colder air coming in, 44 degrees. Sunday, mostly sunny, 63 degrees. Sunday night, partly cloudy, 45 degrees. And that will be the pattern. Monday, 62 degrees. Monday night, 46 degrees. And then beginning to warm up again on Tuesday. Let's go ahead and look at the extended forecast and see what they're saying for next week. They refer to rain as active weather. I guess everything else is passive weather. So the active weather pattern continues as we move into the extended forecast period. Sunday, we'll continue to see mountain snow showers. Accumulations look to be relatively light at this time. Valley rainfall looks to remain limited as well on Sunday, with little to no impact expected. Rainfall totals from Friday into Monday look to be around half an inch to perhaps as much as 2.25 inches, with the highest totals in the north part of Sacramento Valley and in Shasta County north of Redding, where upwards of 3 inches of rain is forecast. And on Monday, the upper level pattern will transition to a more northwesterly pattern. Lingering rain showers, mountain snow showers possible. High temperatures will fall into the low to mid 60s in the valley, low 30s to low 50s for the foothills and the mountains. Lingering rain showers continue into Tuesday. There is disagreement among the clusters. Clusters refer to the models that they look at. There is disagreement among the clusters on what synoptic pattern our area will be under the influence of as we move into Tuesday and Wednesday. So forecast uncertainty remains high at this time. High temperatures will remain in the low to mid 60s for the valley, with cooler low 30s to mid 50s for the foothills and mountains on Wednesday. So those temperatures, night temperatures, mid 40s, still getting kind of cold at night. you can imagine the conversations we're having at our garden center.
No, it's not time to plant tomatoes, and well, don't even think about peppers.
People are planting tomatoes, of course. I have, you know, lots of people that I follow on Facebook and vice versa, and some of them are putting them in the ground. And there's some people who, one who's a very good customer, always plants his tomatoes on St. Patrick's Day every year, year after year. He gets what he feels are adequate results, so I'm certainly not going to argue with him. But I do want to mention...
They turn purple and shiver.
Well, this is true, and I want to mention this. As you're going in, if you're a person who likes to buy your tomato plants early, some of them will have a purplish tinge. We've brought in several flats of the varieties that these early bird shoppers want, you know, Early Girl and Champion and others and Juliet and some of the cherry tomatoes, the ones people I know will want to get. They're buying them because they want to buy them. Some cases they want to plant them. We tell them not to. Other cases they're just buying them to get going, get, you know, start collecting them. They're going to start getting a purplish tinge. Yes, and that's a phosphorus deficiency because of cold soil temperatures affecting the root uptake of phosphorus. They will show some yellowing on the new growth, which is technically an internal nitrogen deficiency, but it's not correctable because it's also caused by temperature. These are not all that harmful to the plant, but they're an effect of the temperature, and they are a form of stunting, if you will. Every cold exposure increases that. Every warm day mitigates that. And so, you know, if there's more warm days and less cold nights, then the plants are better. And if there's, we go back into this pattern of days that are only getting to 60, then the plants will show a little bit of this discoloration. This is really nothing to be concerned about. The quality of the plants is fine. I'm not concerned about that, but you're really not gaining anything. You're just buying them now because you want to go ahead and get them early. This is for the Sacramento Valley, USDA Zone 9, probably applicable to the interior parts of Southern California, the colder parts of the San Francisco Bay Area. The plants will be there. Every garden center has them. Hardware stores are packed. People keep coming in telling me they're seeing squash and melons and peppers and all that stuff at the hardware stores and the do-it-yourself stores. Those bother me, because they will be affected for much of the rest of the season. Tomatoes, you're not gaining anything, but you know the plant will just sit there and wait for the soil to be the right temperature. What can you plant now? Beans. Beans like colder soil. They're actually okay with it. You can even plant sunflowers now, but we'll talk about this later. There was an article of mine in the Davis Enterprise earlier this week about this very issue. And so if you are a subscriber, you can go online and find it. It ran on Sunday, which would have been what, the 19th?
The 17th.
Thank you. On St. Patrick's Day. And if you don't happen to be a subscriber, you can actually still access many articles in the Enterprise. It's in the do-it-yourself home and garden section. And there's a big old picture of a zinnia that I sent along with the pictures of tomatoes.
Wait a minute, it's not time for zinnias.
Right, it's also not time for tomatoes.
So, oh, I see your title. Summer vegetable season is nearly upon us, yeah, but it's not here yet.
Right, okay. And I like to always have a picture of a flower to remind people that it's great to plant flowers in your garden. We'll come back to that article later. We got more to talk about here. KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. I did get an email from the Arboretum, and as they always alert me to the upcoming sales, and something a little different, they're doing one on a Sunday.
They've never done a Sunday.
I don't think so. According to the email, they've had requests for, you know, could they possibly consider doing a sale on a Sunday? And they are nothing if not responsive. And so Sunday, April 7th is the next Arboretum plant sale. Sunday, April 7th. And it's members only from 9 to 10 a.m., but you can join at the door. Public is invited in at 10 o'clock to 1 p.m. So it's a 1 hour for the members to take advantage of the best selection, 3 hours for everyone to shop. Members always receive a 10% discount. You can join online. You can join at the door. You can shop early and save. So the next sale is a Sunday, not a Saturday. We'll see how that goes. That'll be interesting. April 7th at 9 a.m. for members. After that, they're back to Saturday, April 27th, and their last clearance sale, as they call it, is Saturday, May 11th. So April 27, May 11, back to the Saturday pattern. We always like to mention at least one other radio program here at KDRT, because there's something like 30 plus programmers that come in, volunteer programmers that put together shows for you every week. And we've got a new one. And the DJ's name is Rocky Outcrop. All right, geologists. There you go. Cool name. The show is called Yolo County Breakdown. Rocky Outcrop brings you Bill Monroe. Well, let me read the exact description. The Yolo County Breakdown, from Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, The Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through bluegrass and newgrass music, acoustic, string music in the spirit of American roots and country that was born through the genius of Bill Monroe and his bluegrass boys, but which has spread and flowered to be an art form that is uniquely American. As Duke Ellington wrote, there are simply two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. Rocky likes a good kind. Listen to what he's spinning on KDRT. You'll hear it Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. There have been a couple of schedule changes. We've got some new programmers, and that's really cool. So this is the Yolo County Breakdown, Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. All right, so we have a lot to talk about today. Go ahead.
We do. And I wanted to start with a correction. I said that in this last week, we were talking about hummingbirds and bird baths and things. And I said that in my bird bath outside our window, and I keep a list of all the different kinds of birds I've seen.
Really?
I have never seen, not each bird, but it's a new species.
I write down, I knew that. Yes.
Okay. And we had bush tits this last week. That was a new species. Oh. Wonderful. But anyway, I said I had never seen a hummingbird coming and drinking at our bird bath. And I assumed that they were getting plenty of liquid in the nectar that they get out of flowers. Well, it may be true that they get enough liquid when they get the flowers, but I gotta tell you, they like fountains. So Arash sent a video, a little tiny video of his yard with this nice, beautiful bubbler fountain thingy. A very beautiful yard, by the way, Arash, I compliment you on your garden. And there was a hummingbird coming and poking its little beak into the bubbling water. So I went online and I looked up how to make a hummingbird fountain. And it is a thing, man. Mm-hmm. It is a thing. And there are some very, very nice descriptions and explanations of how to do it. And there's this one lady who has probably a dozen hummingbird feeders all in the same place. Mm-hmm. She's obviously back east because she's got these ruby-throated hummingbirds everywhere. And she's teaching people how to make, and you know, hummingbird fountains out of plastic bowls and buckets and ornaments. And, you know, it's anyway. So I amend my statement. Yes, hummingbirds do get fluid from nectar, but it seems they also like moving water.
Well, is there anything? Yes, I've noticed that whenever you set a sprinkler out, the oscillating type, one of the reasons I really like to use those, the kind that moves slowly back and forth. One, they cover a big area, so I can get a large area covered. And if I run it long enough, it gets a really good soaking. All kinds of birds those sprinklers. They make puddles on the ground. Immediately, the ground birds rush over to them. And I do notice hummingbirds dashing through them, and I assume that they're bathing and perhaps drinking. Is there anything about a hummingbird fountain that's uniquely different than just having a little burbly thing on your bird bath, something that makes it move a little bit?
Well, I think that what they use is a little pump that pumps water through a tube, so it's bubbling out the top.
Yeah.
And so it's moving. The ones that I was seeing her make are very small and compared to a big bird bath.
Oh, I see.
And they're just hanging up there, or they're sitting up high so that the hummingbirds can get to them easily. They don't have to get down at ground level or anything like that.
Moving water seems to be the key. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she made these hummingbird, and then she has pictures of these other birds coming in and going, "Ooh, look at this. I want some of that."
Yeah,
coming into the bird bath too. So
I should mention, you mentioned that Arash has a very lovely yard, and indeed Arash does have a very interesting and lovely yard packed with fruit trees. It will be on the Pence Garden Tour this year.
Really?
More about that as we get closer to the Pence Gallery Garden Tour.
Yeah. Okay, so I get to go see the hummingbird flower.
He'd probably let you in on a private visit, but yeah.
Oh yeah.
So hummingbirds are good. Hummingbirds are good things to bring into your garden, not just because they're pretty. We were talking about this a little bit last time. They eat bugs. They're obviously a sign of a healthy garden. There's lots of different ways to do it. I I'm appreciative of people who, like my mother, would hang hummingbird feeders. And in San Diego, you could get a lot of hummingbirds draining those feeders. But she also had a yard full of fuchsias, which were very popular back then, and a lot of other flowers that would draw them. And so I really think that you don't absolutely have to have a feeder. That's just to bring them closer to where you can see them. If you got flowers out there any time of year, and yeah, there's some rules you'll read about flowers for hummingbirds, you can disregard those, but you know, tubular flowers, red flowers, blue flowers, yeah, those are great. But as far as I can tell, by living out in the country and having nesting hummingbirds on my property, if there's something blooming, they'll visit it. Mm-hmm. If they get some reward, and that could be a nectar reward, but could also just be some of the bugs that are on the plant, they'll come back. And once they come back, they're very seemingly obsessive little animals. They'll keep coming back to that same flower and plant over and over. I assume that a nectar reward would make that even more likely. But anything blooming in November, December, January is especially prized by hummingbirds because there's not much else going on out there. So I've seen them visiting Virginia, the little pink flowered perennial that's commonly called pig squeak. I've seen them going to camellia blossoms. I don't know if there's a nectar reward for them, but they do go back to that blossom or that plant over and over. And if you happen to live here in USDA Zone 9, pretty good chance your abutilons are blooming right through the winter, and they definitely go to those. So having something blooming is part of the key. And greater diversity is obviously useful, and probably focusing on some of those things you'll find on some of those great plant lists, including ones at redwoodbarn.com, would be a good starting point. And also, it's good to know that anything that attracts hummingbirds, very high likelihood it also attracts butterflies because of their feeding habits. So, you know, dianthus is one that works like a charm. Verbena. So these are popular garden plants. You don't have to go out of your way to find a special plant. Just try to have as many things blooming as many different seasons as you possibly can.
And one of the reasons to have hummingbird feeders is if you have a yard where you do not have enough flowers and plants to have something all year round, then having that hummingbird feeder out there for those bare times can be very useful. And people occasionally will say something like, oh, shouldn't we take our hummingbird feeder down in the winter so that, because we don't want to stop their migration or be right. a problem with their migration. No, if they're going to migrate, they're going to migrate. And we have ones that are resident here all year round. So for yes. us here in Davis, there's always going to be hummingbirds around.
I heard a great joke. Worry
if your hummingbird feeder is used more at one time and less at another time. When spring comes and they have all those flowers to choose, they might not drain it quite so fast.
I heard a joke once that you should take your hummingbird feeder down if it's likely to freeze solid. That doesn't happen here. Okay.
But remember, the nectar is four parts water and right. one part plain white sugar.
So like antifreeze.
Antifreeze. Yeah. So we would have to get really, really cold to freeze
You probably don't have overwintering hummingbirds in your area if your hummingbird feeder would freeze solid. And I should, one little note, my mother always was cursing at the orioles. The Bullock's Oriole is very common in coastal San Diego. She would watch them land on a hummingbird feeder and drain it. I mean, just she would watch glug, 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 glug as it dropped down. I'm not feeding you guys. So she learned, and maybe this is true, I don't know. She would take fruit, cut it in half, mm-hmm. go stick it out in another tree or bush somewhere nearby on the theory that it would draw the orioles over there and they would stay away from the feeders. I don't know if it kept them away from the feeders, but at least she got to see the orioles eating what they were supposed to be eating.
So the orioles, and in our area, there's not too many birds that do this, but there are a few. That they love it. And if you just like take an orange, cut it in half and stick it cut side up out on a shrub or a thorn or a nail or whatever. Cactus. Yeah, you'll get those, whatever. But the thing about not having the orioles drain your hummingbird feeder, that's going to happen only if they can get their beak into where the sugar water is. So if you've got one of those tubes coming out,
yeah, old fashioned.
At the bottom and that kind, then yeah, they can get in there and go. But if you have what we have, the hummingbird feeding, it's a column of nectar, and then at the bottom there's a red ring, has a number of different feeding stations, and a little place to sit down, because we're nice to our hummingbirds. But the actual hole where they're going to get it is a tiny slit. It's just big enough for a hummingbird beak, but it's not big enough for a wasp or the bill of an oriole.
Yep.
So even if the orioles came and checked it out, they couldn't get anything out of it, so they'd give up.
Yeah, so she would just take a half an orange and shove it on a cactus out in the cactus garden. That was perfect. Yep.
Okay.
All right. This is a garden. This is a garden show, not a bird show. Let's move on here.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes we are. Okay. So we have lots of stuff in the mailbag today. So this is from Ilya. Hi, Don and Lois. I'm your regular listener. In one of your recent shows, you mentioned Theodore Payne Foundation as a good source for wildflower seeds.
Yes.
I went to the site and bought 3 baggies of flower seed mixes. My hope was to grow some California poppies in the front yard. I sowed 2 packages during the recent rainy weather, but the local sparrow flock picked them out almost immediately.
Okay, so it is a bird show.
It is a bird show. I watched this carnage through my windows as the rain was coming down on little birds oblivious to the weather.
Of course.
Oh, they were pecking and shoving at the ground where I had just planted the seeds. I thus decided to start the remaining seeds indoors and then replant them outside once they got going. The seeds sprouted immediately, but now, 2 weeks later, they are still just sprouts and too long and thin to stand upright. What did I do wrong? Is there a way to grow flowers from seeds indoors? Many thanks in advance for your wisdom. Here's a photo of the current situation.
Yeah, it's a very good
photo. Is very sad.
Yeah, I may use this on the show page because it's a good example of the issue with growing seeds indoors. First of all, I've had more than one customer come in and tell me that they felt that they were just feeding the birds when they threw out wildflower seeds, and it does happen. If that keeps happening, and you know you have a habitat such as I do where white-crowned sparrows and their ilk, it's not just them apparently, will come hopping in and eating the seeds, you might want to invest in some wire mesh, any of a number of forms, preferably with a fine enough grid that they can't easily poke their head through it, and just put that over the area somehow. Just set it over there, anchor it down, make a little dome of it, something like that, to keep the area protected from the birds until the seedlings come up. And unfortunately, in the case of the white-crowned sparrows, as you all know, they'll continue to eat the seedlings at certain stages, but once they're past a certain stage of development, they tend to leave them alone usually. There are a lot of qualifiers on that sentence, but that's a usually that I have found by observation to be reasonably accurate. So something to cover the bed, but that still allows sunlight to get in there. You don't want to cover it with something that would cause thin, you know, and unhealthy seedlings. That's one simple way to deal with it. And you buy it at a local hardware store, sometimes the same stuff that I use for preventing gophers. So it's sometimes called hardware cloth, which is an extremely weird name, but some kind of poultry netting that's a fairly fine mesh. And then you just remove that as soon as the seedlings seem to be big enough to leave it alone. Keep it nearby. You may have to put it back down every now and then, but that's one way to protect them, because it is easier in the case of poppies and things especially to direct seed them. They don't generally transplant that well. They have fragile root systems, but we'll get to that in a moment.
One of the things that he said is until the birds won't eat them. Well, the birds do leave for the summer here in Davis.
Yeah, well, we're not going to wait that long for the poppies.
So yeah. Once the birds have left, then if you're planting something, you're good to go. And I also wanted to say that I noticed she said these were flower seed mixes.
Yep.
Now, I have planted poppy seeds with no ill effects and no bird predation, mm-hmm. but poppy seeds are so fine. They're so tiny. They're like smaller than the specks of pepper. I mean, it's really, really, really small seeds. And when I put them out there, I couldn't see them. The birds couldn't see them, so they didn't get to them.
Well, no,
but
I think
it mixed in with something else and they find it, then they'll eat everything that's in there. So I'm, you know,
maybe just try planting more poppy seeds and skip the other seeds that are in the mix. Cause yeah, the larger chunkier seeds might have drawn them in, and then, hey, look, this little crumb over here. Oh, that's a poppy seed. Delicious. So try throwing out some more poppy seed. You know, you're not supposed to cover poppy seed. It's also, I've got to say, late in the season. At my garden center, we sell California poppy seeds year round. People come in, they want to buy them, and we always have the same conversation. The optimal time to plant them is right at the start of the rainy season with the very first rains. They plant fine all the way, that's usually sometime in October. They plant fine through November, even in through December. If it gets cold, it just slows down the germination, but the soil moisture is really important because you don't cover the seed, so it's got to stay nice and evenly moist. So doing it when we're in sunny, dry, windy weather is very very, very challenging. People who plant poppy seeds here in the Sacramento Valley, USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14 or 8 or 9 by their standard, will find that they plant the seed in February or March. It does come up. It does get a chance to bloom. If they get a good start and you water them correctly and you keep them watered during windy spells like we just had a week ago, they will grow and they'll give you flowers typically April, even into May. Whether the plant then has enough time left in its season to set seeds and reseed itself, which is what people are usually after, that's a good question, because you're getting into hot weather is a pretty good possibility. High temperatures will just finish up the bloom of the plant before it gets to that stage. But usually they will set some seed. And one poppy plant will produce as many as 2,000 seeds. So you don't need very many seed pods to get your stand going. So it's late. March, April, not the perfect time to be planting California poppies here in the Sacramento Valley. Fall is the best time to do that. Early winter is a very good time to do it. Late winter is okay. Spring, probably not as great, but you'll still probably get some bloom. The wildflower mixes are generally, if they're accurately California wildflowers, on that same cycle. So they're typically plants that would distribute their seeds in the summer, that would germinate in the fall, grow through the winter, bloom in the late winter and spring, and reseed again in late spring or summer. So generally, wildflower seeds are best planted at the beginning of the rainfall season. If you plant them later than that or going into spring, you're going to have to replicate that rainfall, which means probably daily showers for those seedlings as they're coming up. It's not the perfect time. Now, if you bought a wildflower seed mix off of a conventional seed rack at a normal nursery, I pulled these from my rack years ago. I got fed up with them. They have a lot of things in there that aren't California wildflowers, that aren't even North American wildflowers. Someone posted a lovely picture of their wildflower mix that had grown in their garden in southeastern California somewhere, and the really pretty flowers were African daisies. And I've seen cosmos in wildflower mixes. I've seen sweet alyssum very commonly in wildflower mixes, and those are not native anywhere near here. So wildflower mixes, as sold by national seed chains, are not accurate. If you want actual wildflowers for the region, Theodore Payne Foundation is a good example of a nonprofit organization that sells truly wildflower seed mixes from at least somewhere in your region. They have like a Central Valley mix, a coastal mix, and so forth. Those you would probably want in general to follow the rainfall cycle. But if you buy one of those wildflower mixes, so-called, off the seed rack, planting it in your garden is fine. You're not, you know, contaminating the vegetation of your local wild areas. But you will find that a lot of things will come up because they're designed for success. They're designed for something to come up anytime you plant them. And the things that will come up going into the warm weather are typically not California natives. So that's a bit of a rant, but the problem is that a lot of people plant those thinking they're planting actual native wildflowers, and they aren't. You did the right thing. You went to Theodore Payne Foundation and got something appropriate to your region. Now we'll get to the second part of the question. Yes.
So the second part of the question is, what does she do now? This poor little pack of stretched out. And I can see that at least a couple of them are California poppies, because I can see the new little leaves that are poppy leaves.
Yes, like some of my customers, I had trouble getting California poppies going on my property years ago because everywhere I wanted to plant them was already full of plants. And so I did them in pots, and I made a point of doing them in peat pots, the kind that decompose when you plant them. And so you can get the pellets or you can get the pots. And I can't look closely at this picture and tell what exactly they're in. But
it's a plastic. Plastic.
So that'll be a bit of an issue. But I can tell you that those seedlings are probably perfectly healthy. They're just stretching. And this is something anyone who has started seeds indoors goes through. The light in your house is about 1/8 of the light outside. Rough figure that I came up with years ago by using light meters and a little bit of calculation. Your indoor light is significantly less than outdoor sunlight. So when plants grow in low light, they stretch, their leaves are paler, they will sprawl. The hypocotyl, which is the part between the seedling leaves and the soil, stretches even more than usual. So the plants flop over towards the light and you get these stringy things. You can acclimate those to being planted outside. You can find a place. At my house, it's the sheltered front porch, which faces east. And so it's a little warmer at night, first of all, and even a little warmer in the daytime in the morning. Sunlight gets to it just in the morning, 8, 9, 10, and then it's in the shade of the building. And there's air movement, but it's protected by the house. So there's some air movement. Those are all the things that make a sturdier, stockier seedling. Air movement thickens the stem. actual sunlight makes the plant internode distances shorter. So if you can put those plant little seedlings outside on a nice normal day that's not having a Santa Ana wind like you guys were having when we were having our north wind, Southern California was having their usual Santa Ana wind. Don't put your seedlings out on that day. They'll blow away. They'll be killed. But on a normal day in Southern California or the Sacramento Valley or the Bay Area, put them outside during the daytime. If they're a tender plant, bring them back inside at night. In the case of a poppy, you probably don't even need to bring them back in at night. Harden them up a bit, you know, for a week, 10 days, and then as quickly as you possibly can, because poppies are taprooted plants, gently plant them out in the garden. Some of them will break. It just happens. They're very fragile. I've gone through this myself. So plant a lot more than you need, but you don't need that many to get the whole thing going. Water very carefully to make sure that little seedling is watered. Water them every day for at least the first 5 to 7 days. You'll be surprised how many of them will transplant okay. And once they transplant, they're extremely vigorous. So get them outside, water carefully, harden them up before they go out in the ground. And I think those seedlings will probably work out. And I expect to see a beautiful picture of your poppy garden in May.
So if someone were having sparrow problems and decided to grow seeds in a planter, I mean, this is like a couple of six packs is what the picture is. If you were going to put those out on your front porch, you'd still have problems with sparrows. So you'd want to cover them. So if you're going to cover them in a flat, why not cover them in the ground?
Well, you should. I should have mentioned that. Yes.
Thank you.
That's actually very important. The seedlings will be quite vulnerable to two things. Sparrows. Rats. Well, I wasn't even thinking of them. Let's not go there. Sparrows and snails and slugs, because snails and slugs are out in forest right now with the milder weather we've been having, the dew in the morning and the little bit of rainfall. So going out at night with a flashlight could save you a lot of trouble. But those strawberry baskets that we talk about so much, you know, you should be buying blueberries and strawberries all the time at the grocery store because you need those little green baskets. You take that and you just invert it right over the seedling and you wait until that seedling is growing. It can stay on there until the seedling has actually put out some new growth and looks a little more robust. And I've left them on there until the seedlings are pushing up against the green basket, and that's actually fine. Just be sure to get it off there at some point. But you really do need to get it past those first critters. And while earwigs aren't really out yet in Northern California, I wouldn't be surprised if they are in Southern California. They're more of a late April through May pest for us. Shift all that forward a month for Southern California listeners. They can do a lot of damage as well. So anyone who's planting seedlings out should go out every night with a flashlight to see what's going on out there. But if you're disinclined to do that, the little traps that we use for monitoring based on beer and oil and things like that can at least give you an idea what's going on. So, you know, put one bowl of beer and one bowl of a film of olive oil in the bottle of it, the bottom of the bowl, set it out near the seedlings, go out in the morning. If you have earwigs in the oil, well, you might want to do something about that. If you have snails or slugs in the beer, you might want to do something about that. In the case of those wire baskets, they'll keep the snails out because the mesh is fine enough, the green baskets. Slugs can get through, earwigs can definitely get through. Sparrows won't. So at least it helps with those particular problems.
Okay, let's go to another one. Now this one, oh, by the way, listeners, Don's name is spelled D-O-N, three letters, no problem. My name is spelled L-O-I-S, four letters, no problem. Please do not put a U in the middle of it. That makes it Ulysses and makes me a, Lewis is a boy, I'm not.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Anyway, let's go back to our messages. James writes, thank you for all the informative shows and detailed answers to questions. I want to ask if you could advise me on my passiflora, passion flower, which currently resides in a 3-gallon pot. It's produced a couple of fruit last year and has two nearly ripeness now, but the foliage is much yellow than I suspect is healthy. See the picture. Thank you for the picture. Mm-hmm. I had intended to keep it in a container, but since I understand that this genus is quite aggressive, but now I wonder if it needs more volume, soil volume than the container can provide. I fed it and top dressed it with compost some, but not a lot. It stayed outside, but near a south-facing house wall over the winter, and he's in Sunset Zone 16. Mm-hmm. Can you offer advice on what might be ailing this plant and what to do about it? So first of all, passion flower, passiflora, there's a whole bunch of ones. This is Passiflora edulis.
Yes. That's an extremely important data point. So there's dozens of species and 3,000 or 4,000 species and cultivars in the genus Passiflora, which includes passion flowers, many of which are extremely hardy. There's even one you all can grow up into Oregon and in colder climates, the maypop vine, which is a hardy, root hardy, and just re-sprouts from the roots and can become apparently quite aggressive. Many of the flowering forms of Passiflora are very vigorous vines that can overtake a yard in frost-free areas. I put one in my garden in coastal San Diego, and a year later I took it out because my neighbor had noticed that just like the Japanese honeysuckle I had planted, it was already running into his yard and going crazy. So he and I dug them out together. Be careful.
How many years did you have took you to get that stuff out? I'm on year six.
I took it out the first year after it had been planted. One was no problem. Now my mother had planted alternating Japanese honeysuckle and Passiflora alato ceruli, the only common one in the trade, around their patio there right near UC San Diego, frost free. It made a fantastic screen and it was absolutely beautiful and ultimately became about 6 feet deep of foliage and stuff. And I remember when they had it all taken out, that was a major undertaking. I was maybe, I don't know, 10, 11 when they took it out. And I then spent many teenage hours digging out the root suckers that kept coming up year after year after year, both the Japanese honeysuckle and the passion flower. And I have to note, when we sold their house, there was still Japanese honeysuckle coming up after they had lived there for 62 years. So those are both vines that you want to be very cautious about. However, Passiflora edulis, although quite vigorous, is not a rampant vine and not an invasive one at all. This is the most common species from which the passion fruits are derived. There's a couple others that have edible fruit, but the best known passion fruit you'll buy at a garden center are in the genus Passiflora species edulis. Frederick, Red Opossum, Nancy Garrison, there's a couple others. And you can read about them. There's some distinguishing characteristics of the fruit, but it's one of the more tender Passifloras. So even in zone 16, and here in zone 14 for sure, in the winter, the cold weather affects it. If we get even a normal cold winter, we get some top injury on them. You'll get the new growth will be killed by the frost. The leaves may be kind of burnt looking because of cold weather. The other main thing that happens as soon as we start to get cold and overcast and have our typical valley gloom, they do turn quite yellow here in the Sacramento Valley. And it's true of many other plants as well. So these are subtropicals when they're subjected to temperatures lower than optimal, kind of like those tomato plants you're seeing at garden centers. Various nutritional deficiencies show up and an overall yellowing occurs. Our most common question right now at our garden center by email and people coming in about what's wrong with my plant has to do with older leaves yellowing on certain plants. Most recently, it was a fuchsia triphylla, but more commonly it's citrus, and a lot of evergreens, even hardy evergreens, will show this yellowing of the older leaves as we get into the period when new growth is beginning. You have a combination of the effect of cold as well as plant mobilizing nitrogen up to the new growth from the older leaves, and so the older leaves yellow as well. It's actually normal, but if it seems continuing, if it seems like the plant is not flourishing, it can be a sign. It's kind of reminding you, probably it's using nitrogen, so it might need some. If I were trying to grow a Passiflora edulis in a container, the minimum container size I would look for is something with about a 3 cubic foot volume. That is to say, a half barrel, like a wine barrel, a livestock trough, a big old plastic pot. I've seen some at Costco, places like that, these giant plastic containers. They need at least 3 cubic feet of soil for you to be able to keep it watered and to maintain adequate nutrition for that plant to grow. It's a big vine with a big root system. So trying to grow it in the pot it's in clearly isn't going to work. You would have to feed it. I mean, you could do it. I've grown things in small pots for years because of just by default. The key is constant application of water, constant application of nitrogen. And so you have to feed them all the time. And you certainly have to water in that container in our area. You would have to water it every single day without question. It'd be a lot easier in the ground. Certainly in a big container with at least a 3 cubic foot volume will make your life a lot easier. What it's showing right now is nitrogen deficiency primarily. So regular feeding, as long as it stays in that pot, will make a big difference. It will green up as we get out of the colder weather and we get into the weather that is preferred by subtropical plants. We're getting a lot of inquiries at our garden center, people walking in looking for lantana, verbena, fuchsias, all those kinds of things. And what we have to keep saying over and over is those are subtropicals. The nights are in the 40s. They're not happy when they come in this weather. They come right out of a greenhouse to our garden center. They go out on the shelf and they start turning yellow. So we don't want to do that. And you're seeing the same thing in your garden. It's a plant that really actually wouldn't be growing in this climate, but we can do it as long as we understand that the winter appearance may be rough, or in some years, you know, they might even be injured by cold weather, but you can make up for that by giving it regular feeding with nitrogen. And you've been doing that, but just probably more, more regularly, more frequently, or more consistently. In the long run, obviously getting that into a bigger container will make your life a lot easier.
So you said that part of the reason a plant might yellow is that it is mobilizing things to the new leaves.
Nitrogen, so, yes.
Nitrogen, yeah. So on this picture that we have, are those yellow leaves, are they going to have all their nitrogen mobilized to the new leaves and the old ones drop off? Or are the ones that are now there and yellow going to green back up?
Interestingly, that varies by species. Some of them will green back up. Some citrus that we've fertilized, and we have them in containers that we carried through the winter, we've started feeding them mid-February. We started giving them a liquid, organic liquid fertilizer, and we do it every 4 weeks, and they greened up right away. Others, like xylosma, will, and pittosporum, and even camellias, those older leaves will yellow and drop, and it's normal. And we talk about this on the show a lot, usually about first part of April, because it starts happening even with the live oaks in the area. So they shed the older leaves because it's just part of their cycle. Some will green back up. And in the case of the passiflora, my guess is some of those leaves will probably green back up. The key in the winter, if it's cold weather and you're trying to feed them, organic fertilizers aren't going to work that well, because in cold weather, organic fertilizers aren't taken up as readily by the roots. They're not in a form that the roots can absorb. So commercial nurseries will typically use a conventional or synthetic fertilizer. We just looked for timing where we thought it might work. Like mid-February, we had a warm, sunny spell. Okay, we went ahead and fed them, and we did get good results. If you do feed and it's cold, it'll be a while before you see results. If you use an organic fertilizer, it's effect is slower, but it also lasts longer. So this is one of the reasons I like people to transplant things that they're growing in containers into soils that are enriched with organic fertilizers, which most of them are now. If you go to almost any garden center, their potting soils contain organic fertilizers. And I, as a standard thing, because I have by my own count about 85 large containers around the area that I'm growing things in, I will just top dress a lot of those. I'm not going to replace all the soil in a barrel or a large container. I'll just take one of our highly enriched fertilizers, potting soils, and I'll take scoops of it, and I'll just keep adding a couple inches on top of the pot. I'm going to do that shortly. Actually, as we're warming up now, I'm going to go around and do that to a lot of my containers. And it is a way of feeding with soil, because there's so much nutrient in these new potting soils that you can just use them as a fertilizer if you want to. And that is a very effective way to do it. So top, and also, of course, your potting soils drop over time as the organic material breaks down. So supplementing them can be very helpful. Something to get a steady supply of nitrogen in there will make a big difference. Do it a couple times during the season if you have to, but in the long run, a larger container is obviously going to be appropriate.
Well, Don, it is spring. My plum blossoms are fading. Did we get enough warm weather when the bees were out so that we got good pollination this year? Last year, I had a very poor crop.
Oh, yes.
But this year, I saw them a couple of times.
Yes, this year was beautifully sunny all during the bloom period of almost everything, plums, peaches, which are still in bloom, pears are blooming now, significant bee activity. In fact, a concern I have is that fruit load may be heavy this year. A lot of people had very light crops last year. Now there's varieties that are known for alternating light and heavy crops, like Satsuma mandarins, persimmons, apricots, pecans are all famous for it. If you're a commercial producer, you just go back and forth. There's not a whole lot you can do about it. Many, many, many people had light crops last year. Presumably the plants then put some extra energy into vigor and producing flower buds for this year. For larger fruited types, it will be very appropriate, as it always is, but even more likely to be appropriate this year, to monitor for fruit load and do some fruit thinning. And in particular, again, it's the peaches and nectarines we're concerned about because they're so big and they fruit all on last year's growth, new wood. So if you get a heavy crop, branches break. So it's important to either prune a little more severely or thin the fruit, or more likely both, this year. So monitor them as they're expanding. And the old rule of thumb, it's an easy one to follow, is the fruit should be one fist apart, you know, so which is about 4 inches. So you tend to get a whole bunch of fruit, like all down the stem, let's say 6 fruit in a 12 inch area. You can take out half of them. You're probably going to knock off about half the fruit this year. Most people like to wait until the tree goes through the natural fruit thinning phase, which happens here typically in late April, early May, and then go out and take off the rest of them. Anytime you do it is fine. You probably will need to do some fruit thinning on peaches and nectarines in particular this year. It might even be true of your plums and apricots, although it's less of an issue with them because they're smaller fruited. They're fruiting on spurs, on older wood, bigger branches that can sustain it better. Apples are the same way. So it's typically less of a problem with anything that's spur fruiting. It's the ones like, well, specifically peaches, nectarines, nectar plums, things like that, that fruit on last year's growth, or you particularly need to pay attention to fruit thinning.
And if you didn't prune your peach tree and you let that 3 to 4 foot growth that Don was talking about go, that means you've got a long whip of brand new wood and it's going to be overwhelmed. So maybe it's not too late to go out and cut some of that in half.
You can prune while the tree's in bloom. You can prune later on. People, you know, the most common times for pruning, structural pruning is usually done in the winter. Size control pruning is usually done in late summer when the tree will not sprout at the point of the cut. But yes, there's nothing wrong with cutting back a little bit more as you go. You can do some pruning as you're thinning the fruit, but and the other part is just knocking off some of the fruit. But do pay attention to fruit load this year because so many people had such limited crops last year. Should be a good year for fruit trees, and the almond growers are ecstatic. They got bloom, sunshine and bee activity all through the entire bloom period. Okay.
Canoe shape. Is that something like the size of a squirrel's ear?
Well, I think the end of a canoe is pretty much the same shape world round. And I don't know about squirrels. I'm not an expert on squirrels. A canoe comes to you.
Okay. All right. Okay. Never mind.
Bring them in. I can identify. We actually have people do this all the time. They want to match a grass. You know, they have a lawn. They want to get the right kind of grass seed. They say, well, bring in a sample. I can tell you what it is. Most nurseries hopefully will have someone there who will recognize a different species.
Cut out a 1-inch square and bring the whole thing in.
And it's important to know you have several species in your lawn. So bring everyone that looks different because some of them might be weeds.
Uh-huh. In our neighborhood, I was noticing wagons load of grass and dirt coming out. Mm. And I looked over and one of our neighbors took out their entire front lawn. Now, it wasn't a big front lawn and they didn't have much. I mean, it was one of those places where it was just sod. But the sod came out and I'm going, whoa, that's amazing. Well, the next day I noticed that they're not putting in more grass. They've leveled off and they're tamping down the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that they're going to replace their lawn with rocks
or decomposed granite or something like that. This is one of the most common questions we're getting, and it's a complicated question. In fact, that's a good lead in to one that I have here. Someone sent to me, hey, I'm thinking of taking out 800 square feet of lawn and putting in a ground cover. I saw a picture of creeping thyme. What do you think? I think you should go talk to Claudia, because that's what Claudia did with her lawn 5 years ago. And she sent us pictures throughout. She sent the nursery pictures, and I'll see if I can find them somewhere. She fell in love with woolly thyme, which is beautiful, and took out the lawn and planted woolly thyme, 800 square feet, interestingly. And the second year, that was the picture that you would send to the magazine, as I always joke, because that's when the thyme looks its absolute best. The second year, when it's filled in and in bloom, it's lovely. And creeping thyme, woolly thyme, pink thyme, there's a bunch of different variants, but they are ground-hugging, mat-forming thymes. They're optimal temperature range is up to about 85 to 90 degrees.
Oops.
And they do fine here until they're fully established and starting to get kind of a little woody on the inside. And then you're watering it kind of like a lawn. And her experience was the same one I've encountered almost every time someone does this. Part of it started to die out. That was when we got our first picture and question from her. What do I do? Do I treat it with a fungicide? I say, well, no, you just rake it out and plant some new in there. And by the next year, significant parts of it had died out. And that is the pattern in the Sacramento Valley. There may be places where you're listening where creeping thyme makes a good long-term ground cover. We aren't in one of them. Here, it's a 2 to 3 year ground cover that's very, very pretty. And it looks really nice. Woolly thyme being among the most sensitive to these water molds that typically cause it to die out. No, there's no fungicide that you want to or should be applying for that. It's just the nature of the plant in our environment. So I love to sell thyme to planting around stepstones and along the edge of stepstones and as part of a mixed planting of ground covers. But when you replace 800 square feet of it, she ended up next year taking it all out and planting carapia. So that's the follow-up on that particular ground cover. So the question I got was, I want to take out lawn and replace it with ground cover. So there's like three questions we have to ask when they start. Are you going to walk on it? At all? If so, how much? Do you have kids and dogs, or are you going to just walk out there to have a little table or something? Or are you going to maybe not walk on it at all? Is it sun or shade or a mix? Most of them are a mix, but that's the key question right there. And here's the other, what is there now? If it's lawn, removing that requires a fairly long discussion. You can use a well-known herbicide. You may dig it out like your neighbors did. You may mulch it heavily and wait until it's all dead. Depends on what kind of grass it is. If it's Bermuda grass, it's a longer conversation. You can smother it with a tarp. You can smother it with black plastic temporarily. You can go online and read all these approaches for using cardboard, which we don't recommend, but you're going to find them everywhere anyway. So what the heck?
One of the questions that I would ask, in fact, the first question I would ask is, what is it about the lawn that you don't like? In other words, if it's getting too much water, you want a lower water situation, or you don't want to mow. Well, you could just stop mowing. That's what I did. Yeah, I made a meadow just by stopping mowing, and the lawn got tall.
Yeah, there's some neighborhood. There's a lot of neighborhoods where that would not be an acceptable answer. Yeah,
So that question is, why can't it be lawn? Right. Why can't it be grass?
Because people hate lawns now. Loves to despise lawns.
But that's one of the questions, Don. Yeah. Is it a water thing?
Yeah, and we need to ask. Let's assume you've made this decision. How are you going to use it? And so one of the reasons that lawns are so popular and effective is that a lawn is a population of mixed species. It's almost never one species. It may all be grass, but it's usually not just one kind of grass. The most successful lawns are a blend of different, totally different species of grasses that have been selected to look reasonably uniform and make a nice dense cover. And the national companies that make these seed blends are trying to come up with a mix that'll work just about anywhere. And there are places for regional blends. That's why I sell the particular ones that I buy, because I've tested them and done a bunch of research on it. But if you're going into a hardware store, they'll have shady lawn mix, some that are marked for being more drought tolerant and so forth. But one of the reasons that people do use grass is that if there's a problem, just like in our previous discussion, you can fix it pretty easily by just throwing some more seed out there. The mixes change over time. If you happen to be a grass expert and you've lived in the same house for 20, 30, 40 years, you'll notice the populations of grass species in your mix that you call your lawn will change. As shade increases, the red fescue will increase and so forth. Replacing an 800 square foot lawn with 800 square feet of one ground cover has generally not worked well for any of my customers. Thyme in particular looks great for a couple of years. Diamondia has become very popular. Some of the ice plants work reasonably well. I have whole lists, and I can send them to anybody that's interested, and they are typically on my website at redwoodbarn.com, of ground covers that are used in place of lawns. But some of them die out when there's very high temperature. Some of them die out when there's high rainfall. Some of them can't take low winter temperatures. There's no perfect answer except to use a mix of species. So a design approach to replacing your lawn is probably the best thing to do. Now, I know this sounds a little complicated. You might feel like you do need a designer, and that's possible. But you would probably use one area where you actually do gather. One of the people I talked to, they go out there and they sit and they have a little table they want to place for the table, maybe 10 by 10. Okay, that can be a lawn. That's fine. That can be grass, or it could be flagstone, or it could be decomposed granite, whatever you want to do, depending on how you want to water. A 10 by 10 lawn is not an unreasonable thing to have if you're going to have a little table out there that you sit at and sip chamomile tea every now and then. That would be absolutely perfect. But there are alternatives to that, including, in the case of one who I was talking to, flagstone. It's in the shade, actually. Lawn hasn't done real well anyway. All right, make a little flagstone area or concrete pavers or something where you set the table, and that's your high use area. But that would be a reasonable place for a small lawn. Then you come up with a low flat ground cover that goes around that or in between the stepstones. Then you have medium ground covers to fulfill one of the design functions of the lawn, which is a big open area. Lawn does have a design function. Open, clean, green space, not crowded with flowers, not crowded with shrubs. So there is a purpose to a lawn in terms of the comfort of having a yard that doesn't feel claustrophobic. So there are ground covers that will do that. Medium spreading ground covers. There's a bunch of them. Not things you walk on typically. Myoporum is a good example in our area. Myoporum parvifolium. Dimondia, the little gazania relative. You can walk on it, but you're not going to play games on it. You walk through it to pull weeds and things like that. Behind them, stepped up from those low, medium spreading ground covers, you might do woody plants that spread or have a sprawling growth habit and cover areas. Our native salvias are perfect for that. If it's a full sun area, you want to reduce your water use, very good example. And they bloom in the spring. You want something that continues to bloom, use some of the southwestern salvias to go with them. Artemisias, these are plants that give nice foliage texture, some season of bloom, can be very low water. You're definitely not going to be walking on those. Rosemary is a good example, the prostrate forms of rosemary. And then to make it interesting, and this is where your designer could be helpful, some of what we call in the business accent plants. Leaves that are grassy or iris-like, sort of spiky looking, contrasting foliage, I don't know, silver foliage or variegated foliage. A flower is great, and that's a nice bonus if it happens to have a specific season of bloom or even a very long season of bloom, but they're mainly chosen to provide a little contrast. So on the edge of your stepstone, you might use little tufts of silver fescue, surrounded by creeping thyme. You might use taller, even things like the fortnight lily, that iris relative that's used all over California. Great little accent plant surrounded by the intermediate size ground covers. So they give you some interest and some seasonal bloom, and you can choose them for a bunch of things like attracting pollinators, attracting hummingbirds, and so forth. So you're essentially making a garden, but you're using a lot of things that have a spreading growth habit, can be significantly less irrigation than your turf, and you're confining the turf area, if there is any, to where you'll actually use it. The benefits of irrigated turf: it cools the air right where it is. It cleans the air right where it is. So where your little table is, where you like to sit, that is one place where a little extra irrigation would probably be appropriate. It'll make your yard more comfortable right there, where you'll actually use it. And if this sounds more complicated than you want to implement yourself, most garden centers, including one I'm aware of, have people on staff who can advise you about the plant materials without any problem. A landscape designer could be very helpful if you make it clear what your use patterns are. Our nursery has employees who do on-site consultations. Almost every nursery does. There are landscape designers out there. Look at their portfolio, see how they've taken this very common issue, one of the most common issues landscape architects and landscape designers have been dealing with since the major drought cycle started 15 years ago, where we went through two serious droughts, people taking out lawns and replacing them with something else. My least favorite replacement, if it's a use area, is a highly xeric landscape, because that's going to be hotter in the summer than a lawn would be. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's not going to be a habitable area. It's fine for an area that you don't go out into, like, you know, down by the driveway or something like that. There's lots and lots of really cool plants, aloes and things like that, that'll be fine there. But if there's a place you want to go sit, have people over, gather, you should probably have leafier plants. Doesn't have to be as high water use as a regular lawn, but leafier plants that'll cool the air and make a more comfortable environment right in that small use area. But here's the thing, look at how you actually use your yard. You've got kids and dogs, you may need a big lawn for one reason or another. As we age, we tend to use our lawns less, and we tend to use them in a rather fixed manner. So it's rare for anybody to need more than a 10 or 15 foot square or circular area for the actual use patterns as you get into a different part of your life cycle. And it is possible to have the effect of a lawn, the open, comfortable feeling, with other plants that are much lower water use. And that's where any good nursery should be able to help you, or a landscape designer might be an appropriate investment at that point. You've been listening to The Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.